the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 257, The Bus Factor.
Oh, yeah, The Bus Factor. I'm Mary Tomich.
Tony Bemis.
Tom Lawrence.
And I'm sure one of you will explain why we named it The Bus Factor. And obviously, I didn't store it in long-term memory because we went through about, three dozen names?
There's an article that we'll get to in the news section. But by the way, if we should like a pre-show called How We Name the Show.
Right.
Because it's an event.
It's torturous.
It causes a lot of show delays. We just spin our wheels and get our heads thinking.
Yes.
Yeah, what are we going to name this show?
Yeah, I think it took us 15 minutes today just to come up with The Bus Factor.
I think what I'll do is I'll start the process a little sooner by emailing some suggestions based on what I've encountered and seen.
Wait, so you're suggesting I think about the show before we show up?
No, I'll think about it before you show up.
All right. As long as someone's thinking
about
it.
That's right. So, well, I guess we might as well kind of catch up on what's been happening and our respective open source and technology lives.
Yeah, what's going on, Mary?
Well, you know, I think the last time we talked about it, I was explaining that my printer, I had a problem. I thought my fuser was dead or not functioning properly because it was ghost printing. It would print the whatever it was I had sent to the printer, and then as the page went through it, I see a reprint, a very faint reprint, which is kind of ghost. I guess it's called ghosts. Ghosts in the machine, ghosts in the printer. But anyway, so after my research, I determined that it was likely the fuser because this printer, it's an HP LaserJet 2300, and it's about 14 years old. Mm. So I thought, it must be the fuser. So then, of course, I discovered to get a new fuser that costs a fair amount of money. It's like, I don't know, anywhere from, depending on where you get it, like $80 to $100. So I thought, well, but it's going to be worth it because then it'll be working right. So I got the fuser, and then yesterday I thought, oh, my God, I better get this fuser in so I have something to talk about. So I have to say that there's a site called brokenprinters.com, and they have excellent videos. And they of course, I apologize, so that's why I'm giving a little shout-out here. I apologize that I didn't get my fuser from them, but I certainly used their tutorial, which was very well done. And so I just followed along like a little monkey, and I replaced the fuser, and then I fired it back up, and I printed, and guess what?
It's still there?
Yes.
Oh, no.
So anyway, I have so I'm wondering if there's a roller cleaning. I was very disappointed.
No, it's... Anytime that there's like a image problem on the paper, unless it's like streaks or but it's either the fuser or the drum. Mm-hmm. It's one or the other.
Which model printer is it again?
HP LaserJet 2300.
Before you leave, remind me to look. We may even have a spare one of parts for you. I think we have an extra one.
A drum?
Yeah, we keep entire printers as spare parts because we have some of those here.
Oh, wow.
And we want to keep them alive because they're like 17 years old.
Yeah, because this printer's it's over 10 years old.
Yeah, we have one with a broken gearbox. The gears broke in it, which is crazy. It printed until the gears. It makes an insane amount of noise when you plug it in, but we kept it around for spare parts.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Wow.
Because as long as you don't need the gears, then...
Yep.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so it was very easy. The whole process was very easy. So that's one thing I did. The other thing I did was... I got together with my geeky friend Ruth, who has borrowed my Raspberry Pi, and she's going to be using it as well as her Arduino to put together some projects. So she's going to keep me posted, and I'll be sure to share that.
Cool.
You know, and depending on what the project is, if it's got some open source stuff in it, which I'm sure it will, we can maybe talk to her about it, and she can share. You know what she did. She's the friend who put together a little video surveillance system for her cube to find out who was stealing stuff out of it, and that individual was caught.
Oh, all right.
Oh yeah. Like she configured. Yeah,
and they stole her stapler.
Yeah, they were stealing something. I don't know if it was coins or something. But
I get the reference.
After a while, yeah, she just decided to do that, and she put it up on YouTube. And then she's the same person who took her Arduino and her Mac and programmed it to open and close her garage door. So she's a pretty cool person.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah. So anyway, we may have some info to share on that.
You know, you remember Kevin Wishner?
Yes.
He did a project where with a Raspberry Pi and opening his garage door. And you can open it. And because of the Raspberry Pi, it runs web, you know, and so mm-hmm. the control is through the web.
Okay.
So it's possible. I don't think he did it because he's worried of security, but it's possible to get on your smartphone as you're driving down the road and get in and open the door before you get home so you can just pull straight in.
Yeah, I see that as
– it's been on my to-do list for a little while. And I want a web interface, but I'll be connected to my Wi-Fi, so I'm less worried about security.
As long as you're connected to your own Wi-Fi, then right. you can get into it without having to open it up to the
external world. Because usually, within probably a couple hundred feet of your house, you're already connected anyway. As for me, I'm just going to get out of my car and open the gate.
Well.
That's no fun.
I do have a garage door opener, though. That works just fine.
All right.
Anyway, so that's, I'm sure maybe something else will come to mind later in the show, and I'll say, oh, yeah. But anyway, that's about it for me.
Cool. And Tom, what have you been working on?
Well, I'm wearing my TEDx swag. Because
I noticed that.
Yeah. I was one of the volunteers for the TEDx Detroit event, so that was on Thursday. That was fun.
What did they talk about?
All kinds of things.
Or can you share it ahead of time?
Oh no. It's completely can share everything. Mm-hmm. Now that the event's over, the talks were good, as always. Pick some good speakers. The one that I found interesting is, I guess this makes sense, but it kind of was surprising me. There's a guy locally working on flying automated drones that carry people.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you don't think of drones as being able to carry people. Like, they try to make them really light, and it's more of a challenge, but it's kind of a solution to transporting.
Well, they carry ordnance over in some countries.
Yeah, that's true.
Those drones.
So we
carry what? Ordnance,
yeah.
Weapons.
Oh.
Explosive weapons.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's interesting that they've actually made in a drone like you think of a four-prop drone where it has vertical takeoff versus drones that are flying planes or so-called drones because they're automated. And so we're far more advanced. And now this is what's really cool, electric. So that – and it's because of the Tesla. And that was – what they did was take apart some of the Teslas and go, wow, the technology in this can be turned into use this. And I thought that was really interesting. And it goes related. There's actually some people looking at making electric planes because they can get them light enough. Now, the batteries are still a big factor and things like that, but they're able to provide a lot of power. So that was something from a technological standpoint was really good. We got some kudos here in Detroit because of the Amazon HQ2 thing that's been going around. Mm-hmm. Somebody heard, we're trying to build a second one. The people involved in making the video, and apparently our video and some of the stuff that we did was like the most polished put together. A lot of the other cities did these silly, funny things.
I saw some of the videos and I thought to myself,
they were so bad.
Oh, yeah. I admittedly I have a bias, but I thought that Detroit's video really was pretty good. And I think their package, and again, I'm biased, but I think the package where you've got Canada right across the river.
Yes.
And you have two large airports, and I'm talking about the commercial airport, Detroit Metro, and the cargo airport, Willow Run, which is, about 10 miles away from Metro?
And
Detroit City Airport, which is it's not really used much these days, but...
It's one of those videos, because it's someone who's a famous spoken word poet who wrote that, and a local videographer who put together some of the footage. So it's one of those... It evokes an emotion. And so it's really interesting because if you watch it, it almost like sends chills up your spine because, the whole thing is move here, move the world. And it's very inspiring. It's not – all these other people kind of – they of course, got their Amazons out and they said, hey, Alexa, can I – should Amazon move here? And like as if that was an original idea. And like five different cities did the same video and some variation because obviously they all did this in a bubble, so to speak, and everyone got their video submitted really quickly. Mm-hmm. And it was a short period of time. So – it's kind of funny how they all came up with the same idea.
Yeah.
And someone made a fun of it and they compiled – there's a YouTube video. Someone compiled all the different city pitches that were almost the same. Look, somehow they all had the same idea to use an Amazon Alexa.
They had 200, right. Over 200 that submitted. So I guess we'll see. I'm sure Detroit will make the first cut. We'll see how I'm sure it will because there's some cities that are
– yeah. Well, part of the problem is they need 100 acres. Mm-hmm. So not all the cities like New York They changed the color of their lights.
Yeah, that because like we had a bunch of abandoned buildings.
Yeah, we do, but it's like New York's like, really? Where are you going to put that big of a facility? I'm like, yeah. Mm-hmm. We won't go down a rabbit hole of that discussion. Project-wise, working on new pfSense videos. I released two of them about the two different types of VPN that are built into pfSense. And each video I prefaced with, this VPN is to do this. If you want to do this, reference the other video. Because even I learned there's a couple tricky things about pfSense. I deploy a lot of VPNs, but I never really thought about, like, each one has its own use case. But I had a client that I ran into that wanted a mixed use case. And I tried reconfiguring one of the VPNs by adding a lot of route rules, and it wouldn't work. I'm like, I wonder why. So I dug deeper into it and realized you really just want to set up two VPNs. The level of effort you got to go to make a Road Warrior VPN also do double routing back and forth with another pfSense box is a pain versus if you just set up two separate VPNs and put one on each port, life is good. And your life will get a little easier. So that's why I dove into those. And, of course, I'm speaking on the 21st about the new 2.4 version of pfSense.
Yes, you are.
So that's exciting.
At Southeast Michigan BSD Users Group, and we're looking forward to it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I did my hardware, software review video of the TrueNAS. The only thing, the reason it's still on the desk over here for people in the visual aids, the TrueNAS servers at the end of the table. The reason it's still here is because I have not done all the torture testing. But super impressed. We broke down the hardware, the details, and thank you for everyone who helped me learn how SAS works by sending me some articles and things like that. We've gotten that, and there's even more of it in listener feedback. I love learning some of those technical details I just didn't know as much about. So that's been very helpful, and it'll be included more in some of the torture test videos we do. Nice. So that's going to be I'm going to try and break down some of the knowledge sharing. And you guys kind of pointed me in the right direction where to do this. And that gives me better questions to ask the engineers at TrueNAS to help put that together. So it's lots of fun stuff. Other than that, it's just been work as usual. Mm-hmm. I reviewed some more switches and enterprise hardware stuff. So been posting all that. Those are fun because the video I just posted yesterday is funny. I'm like, here's the review of the Unify switch, and yes, I took it apart. And that's the photo of the thumbnail is I tore it apart. I want to know what chips were in it. Oh, and yeah. You know, it's funny because my guys are like, that's expensive, and you're going to open it up. I'm like, yep, pretty much. Like, why not?
Yeah.
Well, I think
I want to know what's inside.
Sure, and I think probably there's probably a segment of people that want to know that too, but they probably wouldn't take it apart. They'll just maybe do some research.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is to be able to watch your video and really get an in-depth view of what's going on inside there, what's in there, what the chips are.
And we took the TrueNAS apart too. We opened up the circuit boards, and I didn't remove any because I don't want to get in trouble.
Right.
I probably should read the terms of the NDA or whatever I signed, but I didn't take anything that required a screw. Everything I took apart.
Tony, you better edit this.
But I wanted to show the circuitry inside because I think there's a element of understanding the design that goes into something gives you an appreciation for the product, or if you open it up and it's a horror show inside of they clearly weren't planning, they kept adding on. And for example, when I took apart the Unify equipment, the cables are as short as they need to be and no longer because they don't crisscross the board. So where the fan is, the edge connector lines up with the fan. So it's like the fan connector is not at the front and the fan's at the back. The fan connector is at the back and it's at the front. So all the wires are really short, which is actually, from a design standpoint, I see that where companies like, let's put the power supply on the left. Oh, somewhere we changed the design and put it over on the right. So now we have a wire that runs all across the device. Mm-hmm. So when you kind of look at it from device layout, I look at that and go, okay, this is sensibly laid out, and good. I think that's why I like sharing some of the details of it.
Yeah.
So
good.
Nice.
Good.
And what did you do, Tony, besides break your phone?
Yeah, I broke my phone.
Well, I feel so bad. Remember, that's the phone that fell in the water in Iceland.
It did fall in the water.
It survived the water.
And then it survived that water, and then I went swimming with it in Italy.
It survived that water.
It survived that water. And then I replaced the battery, and it survived me tearing it apart like five times, getting that working right. Actually, then the new battery I replaced it with really went bad, and I pulled that out and put the original battery back in, and it was working better. So all of that, and then all of a sudden it does the boot loop thing that the 5X is known for.
So that's weird. I have not experienced that yet.
Yeah, be careful. If it starts to warm up, stop whatever you're doing that makes it warm and let it cool back down, because you do that too many times. It will.
You mean like using it as Google Maps when I'm on a cross-country trip? Can you imagine I'm in the middle of nowhere in West Virginia and all of a sudden I'm in a boot loop?
Exactly. You have to plug in the charger to have Google Maps to run. Otherwise, it kills the battery in like an hour. Yeah,
exactly.
And then, so you're plugging that in. It's doing cell connection because for traffic. And the screen is on the whole time. And that just makes it warm. Well, I did that a lot. And then all of a sudden, one day, it wouldn't turn back on. It has gotten
very warm. Well, I mean, not hot, but I mean, it's gotten quite warm. On occasion.
You might want to like lay it on top of the air conditioner when you're...
Okay. Is the 5X metal or is it plastic?
I think it's plastic.
It's plastic.
Yeah. One thing, and I don't
have insurance, so, you know, the problem is that's great from a broader perspective, but when you need it right, you need a replacement right then. If I'm in the middle of nowhere.
Side note, do you use the Google two-factor?
I have my footprint for
your Gmail
phone.
Account itself.
You know, I do. And the problem is my two-factor is on that phone that died. Now, when I go to set up a new phone, it has to be able to receive a text message. Yep. And if I can't, like I'm trying to use my old phone on Wi-Fi, I couldn't set up my Google account because I couldn't get my text messages.
Yep.
I don't think I do have two-factor set up.
Okay, we should cut that out of the show. But
I don't use Gmail.
Before we get too down the rabbit hole, that's exactly what Corey had, who had a 5X, one of my staff. And what we had to do is take his card and put it in my phone to get the text message to get into his account. Mm. There's ways to mitigate that, and I actually
did a
video.
There you go, Tony. Tom has the answer to everything.
That's right. Next time at 2 a.m. when I'm messing with it, I'll just call you and have you come over.
Yeah.
He'll probably be up.
You're probably right. I'll probably be awake. But one of the ways, if you're using the two-factor, is print it. Print and keep an offline copy. I actually do. I keep all my two-factor QR codes in a safe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's what Steve Gibson says to print it.
Yep. One of the best ways.
I put them on Post-its.
Or you can use like Authenticator Plus, which allows backing up.
Yeah, I think I'd rather do the print it to PDF, but
I like to keep it offline.
Yeah,
and a safe. So just details.
Sounds good right. though. No, that sounds very practical and very secure.
I also have a shorthand I use to describe things, and so each QR code has a shorthand under it, so you don't know what account it's for. So if someone were to go in my safe, they wouldn't have the two-factor. They would have the shorthand related to it, and it's something amusing that I wrote that relates to each account.
Oh, I do that too, where even if somebody finds my authentication stuff, they don't know exactly what it goes to because I've incorporated some little trick to it.
Yep.
Unless they just grab them all. Try them all.
Yeah, well, then you would have to then run through all the two factors.
And, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But by the time I realize things are out of my safe, I've probably realized I should reset my two factors. So
there you go.
Yeah.
All right. So,
anyways, before we go, we've done the rabbit hole.
Right.
It's a
rabbit colony.
Right. So if anybody out there has a Google phone, a Nexus 6P or 5X or something that they want to just like gift to me, I'm open to one right now. Also, we're going to be in New York next week.
Yep.
It's coming week.
So if you're in New York, don't ship it. We'll meet you there.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to be in Manhattan on November, 14th,
Tuesday. 15th, 16th? Mm-hmm. Tuesday through...
Friday.
Yeah,
Friday.
I'm flying out Friday. All of us are flying back Friday, right? Yeah.
No, I'm flying back till Sunday.
Okay. Oh,
I'm flying back Friday night. So if you want to meet for lunch on Friday or something, you know, let us know. We'll be there in Manhattan.
All right.
Manhattan.
Very good. Well, what do we got next?
Next is listener feedback, right?
Yeah. We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show@smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
Well, we put out the call and you responded.
That's right.
And continue to respond. So I think we had quite a robust listener feedback, didn't we, last time we... when did we put that call out?
Oh, last time it was a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So we still got some.
We still got, quite a few this time, just not quite as many.
Yeah.
So
thank you. Thank you, everybody.
Yes.
And my mail isn't sorting like it should be.
Oh.
But.
I have Kevin's pulled up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin. So from 255, he's, I'm fine with the MP3s. Most of the podcasts come that way, but OGG is not a problem for me either. What makes workflow easier is how I would go. And I think, like Tony said, it's probably not a big deal. We'll keep both formats on there because we do have a lot of people subscribed to both. Mm-hmm. Not a huge deal. And then from episode 256, and I'm positive that Kevin didn't look this up, that he just typed it as he listened to the episode. The author no one could remember was Clayton Christensen, who is the faculty of Harvard Business School. Like, I'm positive that is not a Wikipedia entry. That is a Kevin's in his head just running knowledge on the surface.
Yeah, I'm sure it is.
Anyone who knows Kevin knows that he just can rattle off these facts. He is well-rounded. I remember when we've had him guest on the show talking about PinyCon, and he just started reciting poetry. And I'm just like, because we need a sound check. And he will continue. He knows a lot of poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He is a well-read individual. Welcome guest to the show. Love hearing his feedback.
Yes. And, you know, we also had something from producer Dave. And this came in, I think, the last Sunday that we recorded, but after our recording ended, so we didn't get a chance to mention it.
And he must have watched the YouTube that day, because I think that's
maybe
we
he
talked
was
about
watching
it in that
live.
Show.
But anyway, and the subject was KX Studio Tools. And he said maybe you should have somebody on to talk about these tools. Apparently, Dave and his team use them for their podcast network. And the setup is rather elaborate, including two independent VoIP systems such that people in Discord can have a discussion with people on Google Voice if that's how it shakes out.
Hmm.
Would be impossible without the powerhouse audio routing application, Claudia. Now, I've heard of Claudia. And as a matter of fact, I kind of looked into it. This was years ago, and I don't really recall much about it, but I remember in some distro I was using that had a robust set of audio video tools that Claudia was in there.
Hmm.
So he says, I could come on to talk about it, and I would, and I do fine, but someone from the project itself would be better, obviously. So that's something we should be thinking about. Maybe I think that might be interesting.
Yeah, it'd be good. I think we need to get more interview shows out there.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, we've got review shows. We've got some.
And
panel.
I actually have an idea related to that. There's a guy with a popular YouTube channel called The Linux Gamer.
Mm-hmm.
And I bring that up because there's actually a show article I have kind of related, but Linux gaming is always like that big hang up people have going, oh, I'd switch to Linux, but I like games. And he kind of breaks down some of that. And he's a great guy to talk to. I've chatted with him online. So.
Oh, okay.
Cool, might be fun because it's directly related. That's all he reviews is Linux games.
Yes.
And which is, of course, how I learned that there's certain games on Linux I didn't even know were on Linux. Like the guy does a good job.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I think either way, it'd be nice to have producer Dave on, because then he can talk about not only the program, but then how they use it in the real world application.
I like that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we will be emailing you trying to set up a time.
Yeah. So we got to up our game on that.
Yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
we just default to using Hangouts and some other stuff when we do interviews generally. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we've done Hangouts most of the time. And then I think somebody called in my phone, and I plugged my phone into the switchboard.
Very polished mixer. And professional we were.
It actually sounds like a real phone call at that point.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, there's probably some positives to that as far as, hey, it sounds like a phone interview, and that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I like the higher resolution, because phones are so – the resolution is so cut on them for audio quality.
Yeah, it cuts off the whole upper end of the spectrum.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, and then we also had something from Raymond, who he actually wanted to help with the music selection.
Yeah.
Tony needs a little help.
Yep.
I appreciate it.
We all rely on Tony because none of us are kicking in on the music.
Yeah. So poor Tony, he's stuck with it. I used to send you suggestions. I can get back into the habit of doing that.
Yeah.
Because remember, I would put in crazy phrases like Balkan carnival music.
Yeah. It's funny to think about, because I realized some of the shows that just me and Mary did, there's always missing show music. No one's commented on it, but I noticed.
And he's got, apparently there's a link to a good parody song. So he shared a YouTube link, which I've not listened to yet. But,
yeah, it's another.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. It says Linus Said.
Yeah, is it?
Instead of Mama Said.
Yeah.
And the parody song. So that'll be good.
Hey,
that'll be a good one for today.
Maybe do that today.
Yep, that's today's.
So Raymond, thank you so much for that.
Yeah.
See, we don't pre-plan a lot of this. We just found out along with you guys at the same time today's show music.
Yep.
Oh, you know what I forgot to mention things we've done is, and the reason I see is I'm looking through the emails right now, is I have HTTPS turned on for our website.
Yes.
So I'm not sure if it would interfere with any podcatchers out there that grabs our feed. So I'm leaving HTTP turned on.
Yeah, some people may have some URLs. Well, right. We do too, because we set them up a lot of HTTP. So we have our own references that may not redirect as properly as they should.
It would still redirect. Like in Apache, you can tell it to redirect to HTTPS, and it would redirect fine. It's just I'm not sure some podcatchers might have a problem with the certificate. Like if it doesn't check it for the first time, then people wouldn't get the feed right.
Right.
So I'm leaving it on. But I think if you use a plugin like HTTPS Everywhere, I think that's what it's called, it'll automatically redirect you over to the HTTPS side.
Oh, okay.
Very cool.
So, yeah.
All right. And we also had, I think we talked about Kevin's already.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had something from, let's see, where am I here? Chris, Tom, I think you had mentioned this. Yeah, this is the free NAS.
Yep.
Chris, he listened to episode 253, Kaputsky, and had, he actually enjoyed it. Was glad the information was helpful. And then he also had some additional information to share with you regarding.
And that's what I was referring to earlier.
From 255.
Oh, I'm sorry. Details. Did you already talk about this?
No, well, we talked about his email from 253, but then he emailed in again from 255.
Yeah, that's the one I'm referring to.
Yeah.
So anyway, so thanks,
and
Chris.
And it's more details on how the SaaS system works. So thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah, very helpful.
So
very helpful for Tom.
Very helpful for me. I'm researching this stuff.
I won't do a darn thing with it, but we do appreciate it. All right.
So, yeah.
That's all that I have. Did I miss anything that you guys might have?
That's all I see right now, too.
Okay. Well, great. I guess it's time to move on then, isn't it?
Yeah. We're moving on to
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
Distro Fever.
Now, there is a distro that's not on DistroWatch, but I'll put it in the show notes, a link to it.
Yes.
Red Star OS. So someone got newer copies of it.
It's so funny you say that because I just pulled – that's North Korea's Linux distro, right?
Oh.
I just pulled up an article about it. That is very funny you say that.
And there's going to be more information because someone posted someone has a couple copies of like a server edition. Now, I did laugh because the comment section always makes you laugh in Reddit. One of the things is when you're downloading, they said make sure you sandbox it, lock it down. I think there's a special work instruction on how to make it work on the internet. But they said this is, you know, just filled with state-sponsored spyware. And, you know, right away, next comment is, just like Windows 10?
Oh, that's...
And he's like, no, not as much spyware.
Well, you know, and it's funny because they released a version last December. And apparently it can be hacked remotely with just a link. So
it's really interesting.
They may have fixed that by now.
There's someone who's done some in-depth on there. I may play with it at some point and follow the work instructions because it might be fun to review and sandbox and kind of see, you know, it's kind of novel.
Yeah.
When you're talking sandbox, you're just saying from other things that are also on your computer? Or,
yeah.
Or are you going to have it on a different network?
I would run it as a VM with no network interface. That's how I would review it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you can just put it on there and wipe it off the computer when you're done.
Yeah, I mean, that's
what you
should
do
is put it on the computer, then go over to Starbucks and get on from Starbucks. And then it'll affect everybody around you, but not.
Yeah.
Of course, we're kidding. Very much kidding about that.
That's actually really interesting because that makes me think I can set up a separate network on my PS Sense at home.
Mm-hmm.
Plug it into that, and then I can turn on all the tracking. Or
yes. Wireshark.
I can
just
do,
see what
Wireshark or TCP dump is what you would use for that. Yeah.
That would be interesting.
And I could dump all the traffic coming through and see what it's trying to do.
Yeah, I might do – someone asked me this. I set up my own virtual server, and I have a whole virtual lab, and that's for, what it's for is that separate networks.
I see a fresh looks episode coming together right in front of us here.
We could do a whole virtual lab one. Actually, probably that's something a lot of people – because one of the things with Linux is we create these testing environments, and it makes it easy to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We should probably talk about distros in this section of our.
Yeah, that's a cool. We were. No, we were.
We were.
I mean,
we were.
Well,
you know what? Because I guess it does go into how we test distros.
Yeah.
Very relevant.
That's right.
Mary, you brought it back for me. Thank you.
That's right. We were. Hey, and but speaking of being in a fever, there is on the list, and it's kind of red, so that's sort of a feverish color. So that's my segue into it. But it's Red Core Linux. And what kind of caught my eye about this is, and I think it first made its appearance on DistroWatch's list back in August with, was it 1706? Maybe 08. I don't remember. But anyway, this one is 1710. And what kind of caught my eye is the fact that it's Gentoo-based. Now, when's the last time I reviewed a Gentoo-based distro? Or Gentoo itself?
I don't think you did Gentoo. But.
No, from the I know, and so the details will emerge, I'm sure, eventually. That's an inside joke for Gentoo fans.
Right. It's a rolling release, so that's interesting.
It is. Well, not only is it on DistroWatch's list, but I downloaded it and I installed it.
Ooh.
So I'm here to tell you that I am going to be doing a review of this, and I got to tell you my preliminary impressions of it are favorable.
Yeah.
There were a couple things I had to work around. Normally, when I set aside some space for a virtual machine, I usually do like 16 gigs because it's just I'm not going to be doing anything with it, and usually 16 gigs is enough.
Right.
That wasn't enough for Redcore.
Really?
Yeah. The install failed. Well, I mean, it failed only because it needed 20 gigabytes of space. Mm. So I thought, man, all right. So I went, I went back and I reallocated some space for it. And then it was fine. The only other – I had to do a little workaround with the wireless. It saw all the wireless networks from the live CD or DVD, whatever it was. And so when I went to connect to it, it attempted to connect, but it never completed the connection. I tried this about 3 or 4 times. So what I ended up doing is going into the little networking tool and creating a new connection with my the same SSID that it was trying to connect to and with the password. And once I did that, it then connected to it. Hmm. So, I mean, it was just a little workaround I had to do. So I'm not sure why it wasn't able to do it. But aside from that, it's got some interesting stuff in there. So you guys can plan on a Redcore, fresh looks at Redcore.
All right.
So anyway, but that's the one that really caught my eye. And the only other one I'll mention, but it's in a development release, is Ghost BSD.
Mm-hmm. That's BSD, and it's, I knew you'd mention
that. Yeah, yeah. yeah, they got their RC1 out, so I'm going to wait until it comes out with their production release, and I'm going to go ahead and give it another spin.
Yeah, there's a release that's close to that. Is Open Indiana. It's based on Solaris.
Is that when did that come out?
The 31st on Halloween.
Oh yeah, there it is. Yep.
Yep. Open Indiana 2017.10. Mm-hmm. Man, if they released it one day later, they would have had to change the name
to .11.
.11.
Yes, they would. Yes, they would. So
yeah, and it says new version also supports binary compatibility with Solaris 10U10. Mm-hmm. So 10, I guess, update 10.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that because it was called Hipster, and I remember doing that review. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun.
I didn't realize Solaris was still releasing. I figured, Sun is kind of out of the picture, but.
Yeah,
I guess.
If it's open source, I think the only one really excited about is us. I don't know. I don't hear. You don't see a lot of posts about it.
No. No, and actually, there was. See if I can find it. There was this. I downloaded it, and this is not something that made it onto DistroWatch's front page, but it's called Multi-Boot USB Live. And what it is, it looks to me like it's based on Debian because it boots to, that Debian desktop wallpaper, and it's GNOME. But it's very specialized. There's no Office software, none of that kind of stuff. There's just some partitioning tools. And then there's this it reminds me of UNET Bootin. Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
UNET Bootin. It reminds me of that because you're able to then take a ISO or whatever your image is, and then put it onto a USB. And so I haven't done that yet, but I'm going to play around with it and maybe have something to share next time.
All right. Don't you use something like that, Tony, so you can have a menu that boots multiple ISOs off one USB drive?
Yeah. It's not UNET Bootin, but UNET Bootin only does one ISO at a time.
Right. You use something different.
It's called Multi-Boot.
Yeah.
Multi-Boot. Okay.
Well, maybe that's what this is, Multi-Boot USB Live.
Yeah,
that's what this is called. Oh, okay.
Yep, and I have a terabyte drive, actually, that I took.
Oh, well, forget it, then I'm not going to look at it.
16 gigs or something and formatted that and set it on there so I can have my – really what I used it for is I had CloneZilla on there. Mm-hmm. And then Parted Magic. And then I boot into that, and then I can image a machine back onto the 800 gig drive that's, you know, the other partition on it.
Oh, speaking of Clonezilla, that reminded me, just going back to Redcore for a second, you know, the panel across the bottom, it's got a little spot on the right next to the launcher that says drop application icons here. And I thought, what? So I went ahead and went into the launcher and just instead of clicking on something to and releasing to launch it, surprisingly, I just clicked it and held it and then pulled the icon down to that area and pop, it was right there. Mm. So, there's some really cool stuff about that Redcore.
All right.
That was the other thing.
I see that Shark Linux had a release.
Yeah, they're taking a bite out of the Linux world.
What?
Taking a bite out of Linux.
Oh.
I got it.
Oh, my gosh.
Actually, my son plays a lot of kids' YouTube video stuff. And you know that baby shark, beep, 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 beep.
No, I'm
beep.
Not. There's a little I'm not familiar show, with it, or there's Tony.
A kid's music.
She's singing for us.
Anyway.
I'm just kidding.
All right.
Okay.
So it just that popped in my mind as I did it, just because my son's been watching that a lot.
All right.
Yeah. Anyway. So, Shark Linux, it has Mate environment based on Ubuntu. So it looks interesting.
Mate. All right. Well, good. Right. Tom, anything got you in a fever over there?
Not particularly. I brought up that I brought Red Source previously.
Probably we've already talked about them.
Yeah, and then I'd seen the other ones. I knew you'd mentioned a GhostBSD, and we did. How long ago we did a review of Shark Linux? That was a little bit ago.
Oh yeah.
So that was one.
I'd
of the
have
ones
to go
reviewed.
Look. Yeah, it's been a while.
Mm-hmm. It's been a minute. So nothing to get me. I mean, I'm so happy with KDE Neon. You know, I haven't been distro hopping.
That KDE Neon, I tell you.
It just works. Well, I actually found a flaw, and I think they bug fixed it. So I've seen the industry's bug fixes. Occasionally when I would start Chrome, the computer would lock up.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But it wouldn't – you just reboot and it worked fine. And it worked all day. It's just only on first boot, and it wasn't consistent.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems to go away, so I can't complain anymore about it.
Right. By the way, it was episode 230 in March of this year.
Shark Linux?
Shark Linux.
We do a lot of episodes because we're...
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
It just feels like it was longer ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does. So, good then.
Yeah.
Cool. I guess that's it for our distro fever.
Yep. That's it. And moving on.
Temperature's declining.
Tech news and views.
So the tech news for this week by week.
Yes. All right. I think... I'm debating whether we should let Tom go first because
I'll leave it up to you.
I'm sure I'm willing to bet that at least two of my news items he has no clue of.
I kept it short.
Well, first of all, Apple, Apple has they've just announced a cups license change coming.
Yes.
Mm.
Tom says yes. What? Do you have that in your news?
That's not in my news.
Oh, good.
But I read it.
Yes. They do. Apple, here's direct from their site. It says Apple is excited to announce that starting with Cups 2.3, and by the way, the current version, at least on my system, is 2.2.6, but they're going to be providing Cups under the terms of the Apache license. So
nice.
Yeah, and Apache license version 2.0.
And just so people know, Cups is the printing system.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So what's it? What's this an acronym for?
Common Unix printing system.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
And you can do things like in a browser type localhost : is it 631, I think? Isn't that the port for it?
Yeah, I forget the port.
And then it brings up the whole cup system. And it allows you to administer printers. You can do just a number of different things. As a matter of fact.
Right. It's really handy if you're using another machine as a print server and you want to administer the print shares and stuff from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's definitely handy, and it works. You know, printing in Linux has gotten substantially better. So even some of the printer companies offer Linux drivers. Dell, for example, a lot of the Dells have a Linux driver, their website.
Wow.
They can download it. So I thought that was kind of clever of them. I think our Dell that we have here, which we got for free, someone dropped it off when a company went out of business, and it's like brand new. And I went, and I'm like, it probably didn't support Linux. It's too new. Nope. Old printers seem to work great, but new printers are always like a crapshoot. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. It is port 631 on localhost. I just pulled it up, and the CUPS version I'm using is 2.1.3. So I'm woefully behind.
Yeah.
631, you said?
Yeah, 631, just local host colon, yep. So, and Tom, I bet you're probably using 2.1.3, aren't you?
Yep. Okay. Yep. We're both using KDE.
So that's what I have, too.
Huh.
2.1.3.
All right.
All of us are out of date.
We're out of date.
Hope there's no vulnerabilities.
Oh, my gosh.
Or it's the ultra-stable version. That's why
we're all using it.
That's what I'm thinking.
Command line printing options? I'm about to play with this. No.
There we go. All right. Rabbit hole alert.
All right.
Actually, I think they've updated it. This looks nicer than what I remember it being.
It's been so long since I messed with it.
Web interface?
I just use the standard interface and add the printers. And
yeah.
The Ubuntu-based distributions do a great job of adding printers.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. I agree.
All right. I have another news item. Ubuntu is looking for a new theme. Apparently, they're tired of the old theme. And Canonical has shifted the people that used to work on their theme to surprisingly profit-driven initiatives.
You know, that's interesting when we talked about that a few months ago, that they were slimming the company, and we joked around about Microsoft being possible purchasing them. But, yeah, they are shifting a lot of things around. So if it's just like, you know, I mean, that's something that Red Hat did. And I guess if you want to be profitable in the Linux world, you don't spend a lot of time on your theme. You spend a lot of time on a lot of the OS.
Stuff that's going to make money.
Yeah.
I mean,
I like a good theme.
I don't have a problem with that. I mean, you got to eat. So what they're looking for now, I mean, because the article, and this was from OMG Ubuntu, the British site, and they kind of took a picture of that, you know, that old kind of brown tan theme that Ubuntu's had for so long.
Forever.
And yeah, it's called the ambience theme. So their goal, as they stated here in the article, is they're looking, it has to be, no surprise here, GTK3 theme. A new GNOME shell theme, and then a new icon theme. So it sounds kind of interesting. And they're looking for volunteers and people in the community to kind of lead that initiative.
GNOME-look.org is the website I'm trying to think of. I believe that's the one. They're kind of neat because there's a few of them out there, and this is something that's always been really big about community-driven ones, is designing and re-uploading themes and sharing them. I mean, I don't know how much of a dev team they really need to put towards it. There's a lot of wonderful stuff that's just community-driven because people get obsessive about designing their desktops. I'm included in that list of people.
And you?
I want things a certain way.
Yeah.
And, you know, being
Makes
able
sense.
To share those things back and forth. Good news is I mostly just start with someone else's theme and then copy it, so I haven't really contributed much to community. I'm guilty of that, but there's a lot out there, so
I zoned out for a second. Did you mention KDE Look? That's a website.
Yeah, KDE Look as well. There's GNOME Look and KDE Look.
I don't believe those sites work anymore.
Oh really?
Mm-hmm. GNOME Look does.
Oh, sure.
Is it KDE-look.org? Go try it and see, because as I understand it, I thought it got merged into something else.
OpenDesktop.org.
Yeah. See, so it's kind of moved.
Yep.
So,
well, there is store.kde.org, which does have some of those on there.
So, okay.
Yep.
There you go. All right. Well, moving on to the other news that I have. I don't know if you saw this, Tom. I'm sure you have. One Bitcoin transaction now uses as much energy as your house in a week.
Yeah.
Apparently, Bitcoin's surge in price has sent its electricity consumption soaring.
Yes.
And I suspect that nobody's really done the math to figure out – I'm mining at a loss.
That's, actually, a lot of people have done that math.
They quit
mining because of that.
Okay. Yeah. Because, I think it broke over 7,000 this year.
Yep.
And it sent its overall electricity consumption soaring as people worldwide bring more energy-hungry computers online to mine the digital currency.
But, you know,
I understand blockchain, but I don't really fully understand Bitcoin, and I have no interest in learning about it.
If I can hit one Bitcoin every 6 months, that would pay for my electric bill of my entire house.
Yeah. Well, the other weird thing, too, is...
You know, at $6,000 a pop...
Yeah, it went from 7 to 6. It's at 6 right now. It was at 7 like only days ago. So it's still a volatile. Maybe, you know, we haven't done one. Maybe we should at some point do a fresh looks on Bitcoin.
I think we talked about that before.
And DistroWatch has their own cryptocurrency.
Also, there's a local group of people I know that are Bitcoin and mining experts. There's a community group. They meet up weekly, and they would probably love to come on a show and. they love spreading it. It's like a religion to them.
I wonder, we should find out when their meeting is. Maybe we can show up there a little early and get them to talk about it for our show.
I don't know, but if it's not a cougar ant, I'm not interested. Those are South African gold coins.
Oh. That's
all. And that was a joke.
You know, actually, what's interesting, my wife finally like said, wait a minute. I remember you talking about this Bitcoin thing, and I just read an article. There's this lady, news lady.
One of the news ladies on TV?
Not on TV. She writes articles.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I can't think of the word right now. But she did an article on she went around and interviewed all sorts of people and businesses and found out where you can buy without using cash. But you can use either Bitcoin or gold.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there's a Montessori school in New York that you can pay with Bitcoin.
Really?
So she's like, wait a minute. We can pay for our kids' school with Bitcoin?
Yep.
She's like, have you started mining that yet?
Yes, we all missed the boat.
Like, if I started 5 years ago when I first heard about it, we'd probably be millionaires at this point.
Yep.
Huh.
Anyways.
Yeah, so anyway, there's that news item. And then I read an article. Oh, appeals court keeps alive the never-ending Linux case, SCO versus IBM.
Oh, it's not dead yet?
Yeah. No. There was, because I think, let's see here. Yeah, they're trying to. Hang on a second. I got to get back to that.
Back to that page. Our longest case in U.S. history right now is still the Exxon versus the Exxon oil spill from the 80s. Mm-hmm. That is still ongoing. So that's our current longest one. But I'm feel as though this is rivaling it.
Yeah, well, and it's because a federal appeals court, they ruled in favor. I think there were three parts to this suit, and one of them has had new life breathed into it. Which, of course, and I think SCO, didn't they go bankrupt?
I think someone bought the rights so they can keep the floor going. It's just a mess. Right.
Yeah, so they, let's see here. Yeah, their claim of what they did is they appealed, and on Monday, the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals found that SCO's, or SCO, their claim of misappropriation could go forward while also upholding Judge Nuffer's other two orders. And those orders were two summary judgment orders that they... that had refused to allow it to go forward. So, in other words, of these three claims, one of them is going to be able to move forward. So, whether that means that it's going to rise to the rise from the dead as a zombie, I have no idea. But but anyway, I just wanted to quickly share that because I know we've kind of beaten that to death over the years.
It's being beaten to death.
Yes.
Not just by us, but like the court system. Yeah. It's grinding away.
Yeah. Well, they had argued that IBM essentially stole or misappropriated its proprietary code. And in May 4th, 2001, I wasn't even living here in Michigan at that time. I was still in Minnesota. A release of the Monterey operating system, a new version of Unix designed for IBM's power processors. But it was incomplete because it lacked a compiler. So anyway, they released then a version of its own proprietary AIX for power product that included the code. And so SCO's argument is that IBM released a sham version of the Monterey system in order to legitimize its own general distribution of the AIX power. So it's sort of like it was a kind of a false thing over here so that they could then push this other, their AIX system out. So that's kind of what happened. And so... So anyway, apparently Salt Lake City is the venue for this, and I'm sure we'll see future updates until it's finally killed. So, and that I think that's mostly my news.
All right. Well, I have one article, and then we'll let Tom take the rest of it. I found one that it's the Department of Defense is allowing hackers, sort of. So what it started a year and a half ago, the Pentagon opened up a bug bounty program. And and this is really counter from what they've been doing forever. Because if you even thought about trying to hack anything with one of the government websites or sites or something, then they would, they would prosecute you for, under the Fraud and Abuse Act or the CFAA. Anyway, so they caught on to the whole like thing that everybody's doing with bug bounties. And April of last year, the Pentagon had a 24-hour period where they allowed security researchers to find vulnerabilities in their systems. And this says websites.
I would so I'm not sure how deep it went in.
Right.
And whether they vetted the people ahead of time or whether you had to apply.
It was. Yeah, you had to apply, okay. And there was 58 pre-chosen people. They keep on calling them hackers in here, but they're really security researchers.
Yeah.
And they found 138 vulnerabilities and paid out $150,000 in bug bounties.
Oh, that's pretty good.
And then, well, close to 6 months later, the Army did a similar thing where they found 100 bugs and paid out $100,000 in bug bounties. So
the whole bug bounty ecosystem is really, really cool. I believe there's a company open up called HackerOne that helps match people with where bug bounties can be found and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You, as a security researcher, you can really make a living at this. And I've noticed...
Well, you can make a living on YouTube, too.
You can make a living on YouTube as well. It's really been interesting because there's been a couple of people who, like, this is their supplemental college income. And when I say supplemental, they're making like $5,000 and $6,000 a month in bug bounty fees. And this is
pretty
really hard, but it's still really neat that you can do it. It's a more ethical way to do it because in the past, you may find a bug and then you'd have to find a black market person to sell it to. And hopefully that wasn't another kind of FBI agent. You're going right down the rabbit hole of the illegal. The bug bounty method is I'll pay you to find a bug, proper disclosure, we'll close the bug, we'll put your name in highlights and write you a check.
Mm-hmm.
People go, okay, nothing illegal, doesn't pay as much to black market, but
I don't have to look over my shoulders.
Exactly.
So it's a better way to do it. And Apple has been at the back of this. So Apple's bug bounty.
Been at the back of it?
Yeah, they go, we'll offer a bug bounty. They're offering so little money, everyone's been laughing.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they're offering like
10% of.
Yeah, not even 10% of what the black market will pay for things. And granted, there's a big bounty for Apple bugs, but they're finally stepping up their game as well. But this is a great thing for all these companies.
How often?
It was such a big chasm between what Apple would pay and what the black market was.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody would go to Apple because they were paying like $200 and you can get $200,000 on the black market.
It's the discrepancy was absolutely insane.
Wow.
Actually, I believe there's one of the companies in Israel, security firm, is paying over $1 million if you can find a bug in different versions of the Apple. It's $1 million per bug you find. So, So it's lucrative,
right?
It is.
So,
you know, the Air Force also had one this May.
These actually new bugs, or are these just unpatched where you might go by the list of, you know, the
new
vulnerability
unique.
List? And
they
just...
have to be new and unique.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
New, unique, and there's 207 that they found for the Air Force systems. It doesn't go into depth on what systems on here, but...
No, and with the new fuzzing systems and fuzzing things at scale where you can just drop tons of data using a high-end server and drop it on these, we're finding bugs faster. So,
oh, yeah.
That's pretty slick. I like that whole concept. We ready for some news? More news?
Go ahead.
Now I wish Mr. I Have Awk on my license plate was here. Phil's not with us today. Learning Awk and testing Awk. Pretty slick. I got an article links in here. First, there's GitHub with a whole lot of different command line examples for using Awk. And then there's a website, awk.js.org, where you can then test. So not just on the command line. There's a web browser-based Awk test where you can just drop some text in and apply Awk to it. So you can do some learning. And it's probably one of those – there's a learning curve to Awk, but when you have a lot of things to do and you want to change a lot of text or move things around – Awk and Sed are your best friends in Linux, and this helps with the learning because you can learn on there.
Oh, yeah.
So I thought that was pretty cool. It's a pretty in-depth GitHub, and they're always adding more. I kind of like when I see not just a program on GitHub, but I see, like, documentation on something in-depth like that because it's being dynamically updated and just being hosted on GitHub. So that's kind of cool.
You know what's really powerful about Awk and Sed is when you start using it with scripting.
Yes.
Then you can dynamically grab data from here and there and put them into different things and –
Yeah, and
really
search
cool.
for it contextually and put things together. It's really slick.
Well, I think I talked about my little fledgling step into Sed and Awk when I had to parse out information.
Yeah.
And once I was amazed at the power of it once I started using it. And, yeah, granted, I had to Google and I had to do some stuff to know what I had to put together.
I mean, you were doing
together,
things like sorting out which side of the street houses were on for addresses and things like that based on – you know, different criteria.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. I mean, that's the how powerful from a command line you can do this and reparse data and, you know,
or,
repurpose it.
Or in the columns, you know, I had to get rid of certain columns of data. Exactly. I didn't want to have certain pieces of information as part of this thing I was building, mm-hmm. this table. So I could just go in there and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So there's a Wired article, but I think it opens up to a bigger topic, and it's also mm-hmm. the show title called the name of their article is Giving Open Source Projects Life After a Developer's Death and the Bus Factor. What happens if a developer gets hit by a bus? It's always a proverbial term we use here in English.
The Bus Factor.
So yeah. That's where the name of the show comes from,
that's
huh?
Where the name of the show comes from. So this is something that has been a problem for closed source communities. If a company goes down and they didn't have their source code in some type of escrow that you could get to, because that's actually I've learned in some of the other corporate environments I've worked in, when we've contracted to do it, they set up a code escrow. And basically the code escrow says if that company goes out of business, we'll just release the source code to you automatically. It's usually kept with the law firm. So those mm-hmm. are some of the ways this happens when you pay a developer to do something but you don't get the source code. But you can see how that could go wrong, and you still not end up with a source code, and the company dies, the product completely goes away with it. So in open source, this is really less of a concern. It's another reason to help advocate for open source. It's on GitHub, wherever that project is. Mm-hmm. Even if we're somehow locked out of that GitHub account, we have all the source code. We can simply fork it from there, and you know the project can still live on. We have all the source code. We can pick up where that person left off. And it's not just getting hit by a bus. Some people just they take a job. And they go, you know, this was a college project. I don't really have time anymore. I got hired by XYZ company. And they can just give up the source code really easy. Or sometimes they don't know who to hand it to. But then someone realizes they want that package maintained and updated. And someone else grabs and runs with the torch. Mm-hmm. So this is, you know, it's an interesting read. It's an interesting way to think about things. And it's another reason that we should all be using open source. So not just a good show title, good idea. Now, I threw this in here and I mentioned it during our listener feedback. Call of Duty, World War II, the new game that's out. How much money do you think it made in its first 3 days?
$10.
What was that?
$10.
A little more than that. I know we...
Tony, $10.
$500 million in 3 days.
Holy cow.
People sometimes forget about the scale of games.
And the addiction.
Well, the addiction. It's a whole other thing. Well, there's actually colleges now giving scholarships for games. There's a lot of stuff going on related to games. It's really
playing the game more.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, esports is a real thing, and it's been very legitimized. Mm. And what gives it legitimacy is there's $500 million made off of this game. And the reason I bring this up and relates to us is I talked about, like, the Linux gamer. And it's mm-hmm. often a hang-up I hear amongst my peers in technology of why they're not running Linux or they run a dual boot machine, and we're starting to see it come the other way. My eyes have been even open to how many games are available on Linux, and I think
Super Tux Cart.
We think of some of those and some of the bad ones.
I just installed it.
It's all right. Yeah, it is kind of cool that it's coming around, and but it's coming around slowly, but we're getting there, and it's got me excited. So I thought I'd mention that. Just the number blew my mind when I seen it. It's mm-hmm. not absolutely related to us, but wow. That's
yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't believe the number when I heard it. I went and Googled it and found the articles. So related to Microsoft, we're going to talk to them. Here's our question for them next week. Microsoft says 40% of all of its VMs on Azure are running Linux.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and my question is, if they took a kind of a mm-hmm. hack of that, say 6 months ago, what was it then, or a year ago? I'm just kind of curious if there's a trend.
And it's something I want to hear if our listeners have some questions about that, because we on our interview list is person involved and head of Azure and things like that, and talking about some of the new things coming out. What questions does our audience have about this, and what should we ask? And we have our own, you know, things, but they have their opinions. Oh, they have their opinions.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, someone's just going to say, you know, ask them why Windows 10 isn't open source. We always get those comments, but that's not.
Yeah.
This is specifically to Azure. And it's kind of your stuff has to be run somewhere. And I'm advocating, so to speak, directly for Microsoft, but when it comes to your cloud services, you have Azure and you have AWS and you have Google. I've seen more people talk about, because of incidents that occur, running your stuff in mm-hmm. two different places at once. And mm-hmm. part of what makes it popular in Linux is very non-proprietary, and you can then load balance across two data centers, and that's a really cool mm-hmm. concept.
Yeah.
So if AWS, if someone has a typo again, you can just bounce over to the other for redundancy. So kind of neat.
Exactly. Yep.
KeePass gets its own PPA. So if you are a big fan of like the KeePass X for password management, and it's probably one of the best open source password managers out there, they have their own PPA now to keep it all up to date and everything. So that's actually clever. I like that. That makes me happy. So that's a definitely a good thing there. Someone did point out, and maybe we should have a topic discussion about this one of these times on FreshLicks, but you know, when you start adding all these PPAs, you're saying I trust root level to that PPA, and that does bring in a little bit of concern.
I've thought about that.
Yeah, I currently, because
just before I automatically imported the the repository and install whatever it was. But I do think, at least I think about it.
I think about it as well. I consider it a lot because I don't have, I think I have the only PPA I use is the one for, I don't think I use any.
Handbrake, I use that one.
Caden Live, I would use theirs. That's the only one. But it is a concern.
But that's different though, isn't it? Am I oversimplifying it? You're adding it. But that's a well-known application.
Yes.
Unless the developer snuck something.
Exactly.
Snuck something in there. So,
that's something I always think about.
Like, that's Tony rattling the Timbits.
Right. Not necessarily the developer, but if they get hacked.
Right.
Their machine, one of... It's not just the developers.
And they would just do it once. They would hack. They would drop the file in there, and then they would leave and never, you know, not come back. And you, unless you really did a deed diff, or what is it called, where you really, I know there, in development, there's probably some utility that allows you to check the difference between two files. I mean, I know DDIF, but
yeah. But still, it's a big concern as you add all these PPAs, especially when you're talking about a password manager. Because this is a really this is a really valuable asset to have. Like the knowledge of everyone's passwords is huge. So I thought about that. Like, you know, that's interesting. But then again, you're generally downloading the binary anyways. I'm not compiling for source every time I've used that program. So there's just a litany of issues here.
But right.
Can we trust the machines that we're working on? And my last article is PIA. So they're a private internet access, a VPN company. And I like their contributions back to open source. So we've covered PIA in the past because they did an independent paid someone to do an independent audit of OpenVPN 2.4, which some people thought was controversial. Like, why are they doing it? Because actually the Linux Foundation, I believe it was, sponsored another one. But it's actually nice to have two separate companies doing code review. Now they're supporting KDE. They are on the board and a big donor list. So
we talked about that too. I think we briefly mentioned that a few episodes ago that they had they had joined that.
And now they're also a big sponsor throwing money at them too. So
nice.
I didn't realize also they're also a donor for Krita and the Matrix Communication, the open source communication. So kind of
nice.
Cool. Yeah, that's something novel though that they're – I like that they're a company that's realizes that they built on open source technology and they are – clearly dedicated to giving back to the technology that their systems run on. So definitely good. And there's been other VPN companies that have been less than scrupulous.
That's worrying.
One at least has been pretty honest as a VPN company can be.
Right.
So they've been very open about all their stuff. And that's what I have for the news.
Wow.
Right.
Man, that's a lot.
I try not to go crazy with it. Like, I'm just...
No, interesting stuff.
I try to keep it Linux focused because there's all kinds of things I wanted to rant about. Like, Tony, were you affected by the internet breaking on Monday?
I thought that was a hoax. And then somebody published a Comcast outage map, and I'm thinking to myself, "Oh, I'm glad I don't have Comcast." I didn't appear to be really affected by it.
Yeah, I saw Tom post that, the outage map.
Is that okay? I saw your post, and then I saw somebody else had posted it too.
I did a whole video because I also found a really awesome BGP exploration tool. Someone made a visualizer for all the BGP routes. It's amazing.
Really?
And it's really fun to play with because it's not 3D, but it gives you this really cool – if you want to understand how the internet's connected. And the internet, we think of it as a bunch of computers connected together. But first, and this is what BGP handles, the internet is a bunch of networks connected together. So this doesn't look at the computers that are connected to the internet. This looks at the networks that are connected to the internet and how someone made a typo at level 3. That typo, because level 3 is so big, and actually that's one of the things I do is I show that I group out just level 3's network and boom, you can see that, wow, that one company has touches everything. So everything traverses their network. Uh-huh. And because Comcast traverses much of their network, so when you leave Comcast and get to many other websites, including Azure, which caused 2 hours of downtime for business class Comcast, but not consumer, business Comcast routes across level three over to Azure. So when they typed in a BGP route wrong, people broke it broke their Azure connections.
Oh, man.
So
was Amazon affected by that?
No, I don't believe they were.
I wonder if that's a question we should bring up during.
And here's what's weirdly, this is a little insight for how we run our business. The remote support tool we have is self-hosted on the Comcast network, and the majority of our retail customers have Comcast, and a lot of our business ones do. Completely unaffected.
Because right, because you stayed within
Comcast. We stayed within Comcast network. So we actually were able to remote, because they said our internet's not working, but when we jumped in remoted in our computer, we're like, well, actually, no, and we didn't understand what was going on either. Mm. And then we started understanding the problem better and started reading the news and looking at it and then found out someone at level three admitted, oops. I'd love a debrief
on that. That's interesting. Yeah, I'd like to see that too.
Yeah, I got to look for it, but at least we understand what happened. We want to know why it happened and how it's not going to happen again.
Right.
That's disruptive.
Well,
how it's not going to
happen. Well, technically why it happens is because there's no real authentication
for
between BGP. Yeah, for BGP. So anybody at level three, you know, that has access to their equipment can update a route. Well, if they put in the wrong IP subnet in the route, then it will redirect somebody else's subnet to them.
Even by a typo.
Just a typo, yep.
And that's actually where the way BGP was designed in the early days, it was no problem because we realized that the 10 block belonged to this group and the 11 block to this group and the 12 block to this group. So everything was – there wasn't many routes.
Right.
Well, we have subdivided all these networks out to such a finite scale that the BGP tables, which were a few entries, someone said the BGP is like over a million entries now. So
it's huge now. Yeah.
One of the problems they had with as the internet grew, they didn't have enough storage memory in the large routers to store the BGP tables. Wow. Yeah. They didn't expect them to get that big.
Yep, that happened, what, 5 years
just
ago?
Just like Bill Gates didn't expect we'd need more than 640K.
Same concept.
Now, refresh my memory, initials.
Border Gateway Protocol.
Okay.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, it's a routing protocol.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And it's the big level route. So the internet routes through IP ranges and figures out. And then Border Gateway Protocol is to figure out the gateway for each bordered network. So, you know, my network is this range, and then this network is that range, and it's the border. Now, the cool thing is on the visualizer is playing with the DoD's BGP routes because you can see how they're interconnected. And it's really cool because you can visualize how the DoD network is separate, but how it interconnects. And this is what's really cool about the way BGP. They can't hide that. If they hit it, it wouldn't work. So you have to publicly publish your BGP tables or you'll never route. So you actually get to visualize how their networks are interconnected and through which agencies the DoD gets internet
access.
I could
see that valuable info to some people.
Yeah.
That's well known.
What's interesting at the hospital, we have some public space, IP space obviously. And to get that public space, we use BGP. And what's neat about BGP is it allows you to switch internet providers and keep that same address space.
Yeah.
So
that is convenient.
We can have ATT 1 minute and shut off the ATT connection, turn on the Comcast connection, and then all of a sudden BGP would update to come through Comcast. Well, they were trying to switch our one data center from ATT to Comcast. Or no, it was from Sprint to Comcast. And when they switched it, the Comcast connection took the whole address space instead of like splitting it between our two data centers. So that everything that was supposed to go to ATT in our other, on our smaller data center just went away, and it all went to the Comcast.
Was any surgery going on?
No. It was scheduled at the right time so people wouldn't be affected.
Yeah. But BGP is a fragile, complicated system.
Oh, yeah. So. Yeah, because it's so huge now.
But it's absolutely a critical piece of infrastructure and is as resilient as the internet is where you can take down nodes and it reroutes around it. If you don't have that routing set up right in BGP, you break the internet.
And it depends on how much control you have. I mean, if you're
at level three,
open it up too big.
Breaks BGP on his small network, no one even notices but me.
Exactly. Yeah, but level three can break a lot of things.
Yes.
Because they are one of the major backbone providers.
They were until they got bought by CenturyLink, and now they are. So CenturyLink bought level three, and now they're that consolidation of power, the two biggest were Level 3 and CenturyLink. Now they're the same company. So,
jeez.
Yeah. Anyways.
All right.
That rabbit hole's.
No, I think that was interesting.
Yeah, the fundamentals.
Router network guys were probably just salivating listening to that.
Hopefully we have that
I
right.
I was salivating. Look at you, Timbits over there.
You have some more?
I mean, these Timbits.
Oh. Timbits.
I'll have a Timbit. All right. Sorry for all the extra mic noise coming here, guys, but these are Timbits, and these are important.
Tim Hortons.
Tim Hortons is sponsoring this particular show. Well, actually, we paid for it.
Yeah. All right.
Now, we have some music for the show, I think.
We do. Yep. And it's the one that was sent in by, what's his name? I can't think of his name right now.
Let me see if I can help you.
Raymond.
Yes.
Raymond. Thank you, Raymond. And it's the parody song that is, where'd that page go? Linus says.
Remember back in 1991, you posted on a Minix using a group. Just a hobby won't be big at all. Started out with Bash and GCC. On a T-disc is where it could be found. People loved it and it got passed around. A multi-threaded file system running on a 386. Well, then it said that it was open. Then it said that it was GPL. All could use it for whatever they like. And it was okay. Is a thing to do. Little penguin did him at the zoo. Larry Ewing drew it up for view. Got the name for ducks from James Hughes. Richard Solomon found it canoe. Emacs and GCC2. License under copy left is true. Code is free as in speech for me and you. Linda said that it was open. Linda said that it was GPL. All could use it for whatever. Desk is known. When I go surf the interwebs, my browser is Chrome. When my friends ask how it thrives, and how Linux keeps all of it flowing, benevolent dictator for life, that's why I'm okay. I said I'm okay. You know what Linus said? You know what he told us? Well, Linus said that it was open. Linus said that it was GPL.
Yeah.
But so in the edited version,
that's right.
You'll have the whole thing.
You who are watching the unedited version just saw me do the yes. slit across the throat. Like, how did I have to go?
Got stuff to do,
right? Yeah. But that's
on the Lions game. Okay, same, I'll admit it.
She's got her Lions shirt on.
Yeah, that's right.
Same group that does a lot of the Linux parody songs. You know, by Susie.
Oh my God! Yeah.
So this is by Susie.
Oh, those guys. Those guys are so darn funny. Yeah, makes me just really want to use SUSE Linux just because of them. All right.
But, yeah. So, thank you very much for letting us have these songs. That's pretty cool.
Tom, I'm going to leave the draft beer jelly beans here.
Oh, they will get consumed.
Okay.
Ooh, I didn't see those.
Or you can have, you guys can share them.
We're going to have draft beer jelly beans.
That's right.
All right. So you've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 257.
D-Bus?
No.
What was it?
The bus factor.
The bus factor. That's right.
I had that. I'm sure I had the deer in the headlights look.
Like you were getting hit by a bus.
That's right. Exactly. Driverless bus. All right. This is Mary Tomich.
Tony Bemis.
And Tom Lawrence.
We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.